We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Meditation Studio. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who have devoted their lives to teaching and helping others through meditation. In today's episode, I interview Colleen Sedman Yee. Colleen is a master yoga teacher, studio owner, model, and author of a book called Yoga for Life, which chronicles her personal journey and includes yoga practices and meditations that will support us all on our path to inner peace. The New York Times calls her the First Lady of Yoga. She believes that yoga and meditation give us the tools we need to overcome the obstacles that stand between us and freedom, joy, and gratitude. Her story is honest and extremely tender-hearted. Before we begin, don't forget to check out Meditation Studio app in the iTunes App Store. And if you have suggestions for future guests, email me at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. Now, here's Colleen. Colleen, it is so great to be here with you today.
Thank you, Patricia.
Yeah, it was such a privilege to read your book and to hear your story, and you know, want to share it with our audience because there's such a richness to your life. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I was actually born in New York, in upstate New York. My father's a factory worker. Well, he worked what was called the swing shift, and was offered a job in Indiana and promised that he could work days. And with seven children, my mom needed him to work days because nights were very difficult for the family. And my mom never rooted in Indiana, never wanted to be there, was very sad about having to move away from her entire family. Mm. So we were raised in Indiana. As a young girl, I was a complete jock. Mainly to try to keep up with my five brothers.
Right.
And I was also a perfectionist. I had to get A++++s to the point that I ended up having a bleeding ulcer in third grade.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was, I mean, it was a pretty normal upbringing for the most part. But then, as you know from reading the book, when I was 15, I was run over by a car.
So you were out with your friends in this dark road.
Actually, it wasn't dark yet. It was at dusk.
Mm.
And we were tripping.
Right. Was that your first experience with
drugs?
No,
it wasn't my first experience.
So when did you start getting into drugs?
I started drinking and getting high probably at 13. But we were in Indiana. There was nothing else
to
do.
You were
it was
bored.
Not uncommon.
Okay.
It was boredom. It was maybe peer pressure. I put a lot of pressure on myself as well. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of nice to get out of that mode of being so self-berating and thinking that I could fix my mom's sadness and whatnot.
Was she depressed? Or when you talk about her being sad?
She was never diagnosed as depressed. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess they didn't really do that so much back then. But I would just watch her, you know, look out the window and smoke cigarettes and cry and thought that somehow I could fix that. You know, I was obviously doing something wrong.
Right.
And so after the accident, though, I suffered brain damage. And what went from a perfectionist A-plus student, I was having to study really, really hard to get C's. And nothing devastates me more. I'll still tear up just thinking about that. That was the hardest thing that I've ever had to go through, because my identity was wrapped up in being an A++ student.
Right.
I mean, I would if I got an A-, I wasn't worth anything anymore.
So what happened to your confidence? Were you just...
Well, at that point, I started doing more and more drugs.
Okay. Because you were just feeling so tenderhearted.
Yeah, I just needed to cover up, run away.
Right.
More than anything.
Yeah.
I was so frustrated. And externally, I guess you wouldn't have noticed it so much, but internally, I was a different person. And I was not familiar with that person.
What, were you told that your brain would sort of regenerate and repair itself over time, or were you...
You know, nobody even told me that
that
I had damaged my brain. And I think that it was sort of the chicken or the egg.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably people thought because I got into drugs.
Right.
But it was really the other way around.
Yeah. Well, that was a pivotal point for you, because... when we look at your whole story, that seems like that was the first moment of really realizing that you're frustrated with who you are and what's happened to you.
Right.
But then the story continues.
I had a short bout in college,
and
I was in love with a drummer of a rock and roll band, and that's all I wanted to do was do drugs and be with him. And so I left college, much to the chagrin of my parents, because my dad had never been to college, and his mojo from the day we could learn to speak is, you are going to college. So he was very upset, needless to say. But they didn't realize how far down the rabbit hole I'd gone. They didn't realize that I was actually a heroin addict at that point.
Now, how did that happen? Was that the next phase of tripping, or was this the whole new era of you?
No, that was a whole new era. I'd started with something called Quaaludes.
Right, of course.
And I loved them. They made me feel comfortable again, in my skin, in my body. And then it was cocaine. So I don't ever remember walking into a house where there wasn't a mirror and rolled up dollar bills. There was always lines of cocaine. So it ended up to be, you know, cocaine during the day and then lewds at night. And that led to heroin.
So what? So did you become addicted? Because your story isn't as much an addiction story.
Mm-hmm.
How did you stop?
Yeah, that's a really good question and delineation, because to this day I keep telling Rodney, no, I wasn't an addict. And he was like, well, you took heroin every day.
Yeah, you're kind of an addict.
Yeah, and I'm like, no. I felt like I was never mentally addicted to it. I was physically addicted to it. And I needed it to feel normal.
Right.
You know, and so I was actually coming off of a 3-day binge, blackout really. And my dad called and said, you know, I expect to see you at your brother's graduation. And so I put on a white jumpsuit inside out, unbuttoned to my navel, and went to the graduation. And I could barely stand up.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't talk. My parents thought I was drunk and told Peggy not to let me come to the party.
Peggy's your sister.
My sister.
Yes.
Because that was embarrassing. It'd be an embarrassment for the family.
Yeah.
And then Peggy told them that, you know, I wasn't drunk, that I was in serious trouble. And then that led to my dad, you know, trying to do an intervention to get me to go to rehab, and me again saying, I'm not what you think I am. You know, I just do this, you know, and I can stop doing it if I want. So rather than go to rehab, Jeff and I got in the car and drove to New York City. And then, you know, realized that we didn't have enough money to live in New York City. So that's when the modeling came in. It wasn't that direct of a route. I started working at a sort of a seedy club. And this man named Zoli walked in with his lover. And I was coat check girl because I was such a lousy waitress. And he said, you know, you could be a model. And at that point, I was used to people offering many seedy things, which I came very close to taking them up on.
For money.
Yeah. And I thought it was, you know, one of those. But I took his card and I went to see him and it was legit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And very soon after I was in Paris.
Right. And thus begins your modeling career.
And thus began the modeling career, which saved my life.
Right. And so what we've skipped is that you were struck by lightning on a camping trip when you went back to visit your brothers.
Right. That Saturn return that everyone talks about.
Right, right.
And my brothers go on a camping trip every year, and the girls aren't allowed. It's just the boys. So I had just broken up with who I thought was the love of my life, or he'd broken up with me, refused to marry me and whatnot. And I was just devastated, and I said, I begged them to go. And so finally they conceded, and they're like, you know, you're carrying your own canoe, and you're going to, you know, no special anything, and blah, 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 blah. So I went with them, and I was up to the task. I was very physically fit, and we got struck by lightning. We were on an island. There was a terrible storm.
Right. You all got struck by
lightning. We all got, well, two of the brothers never got jolted.
Okay.
But the island definitely got struck. And the island right next to ours, two girls died on the island next to ours in that same storm.
Wow.
It was a vicious storm.
Yeah. And you seem fine afterwards, or right away you think that there's a problem?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It was hard to tell. Like, my hair was burnt. The tent, the roots of the tree were burned into the tent. We were all pretty much in shock.
Right.
A couple of my other brothers had more severe ramifications. And, you know, life went on as usual. I got home and I'd had a letter there waiting from the Missionaries of Charity.
Right. So when
this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Since you were a little girl, you were writing to Mother Teresa.
I saw a spread in Life magazine of Mother Teresa as a young girl, and the address was there, 54A Circular Drive, Calcutta, India. And so I started writing. I never really expected. It was sort of like journaling.
Right.
Except for I put it in the mail.
And you told her what you were feeling?
I told her how my brothers picked on me, and I was going to be a nun from a very young age. I was sure I was going to be a nun. That was my path. And then I had sex, and that went out the door. I was like, no, this is too much fun. I'm not going to be a nun. But, so yeah, and then for whatever reason, I got a letter from Sister Priscilla, which is her right hand, and says, you're ready to serve the poorest of the poor.
So that's when you went to Calcutta.
That's when I went to Calcutta.
And is that when you had your first seizure?
I had my first seizure in Calcutta.
Yeah, because in the book, Colleen talks about being on a very, very crowded train there. It's very uncomfortable,
yeah,
and packed with people and animals
and everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
And you start to have a seizure, your first seizure.
My first seizure, it's funny, I have some memories of it. Like, I remember opening up my eyes and just seeing lines of people looking at me.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it's like, why do they all have towels on their head? You know, I had no frame of reference. What happened? Why is everyone looking at me? Why am I in so much pain? And then I continued to have several more seizures on the train. I was with my girlfriend, and I mean, basically everyone thought I was going to die.
Right.
Like, my pulse was down in the 20s. There was a doctor on the train who actually spoke English. And I remember nothing else other than that one moment of looking up and seeing all these people. The last thing I remember until I woke up in some hotel room, close to Varanasi, which is where we were headed.
Right.
But Dawn was like, you know, the woman I was traveling with is like, you know, stop the train. I have to get my friend up. We need medical attention.
There was no place to take
you. And the doctor was like, you know, if you don't want her to die, there's no place here that you would want to take her. So he got a hold of somebody, I don't know how, in Varanasi. And when we got there, there were men waiting to carry me.
Okay.
And they carried me to this hotel, and a doctor came to the hotel, and basically they're getting ready to ship my body. They gave me fluids and I don't know what else. And I continued to seize. I fell off the table and seized another time there in the hotel. And then, you know, I recovered.
Yeah,
I mean, I was in agony for the rest of the trip. My body just hurt so badly, and I didn't realize that I'd broken ribs. I still have incredible pain in my back from those seizures.
Wow. And then you started on, when you came back to this country, you started on medication for...
You know, I didn't start on medication right away. So when I came back, I was actually on jury duty.
Came back to the...
To the United States. And I was on jury duty, and I had a seizure on jury duty.
Yeah.
And again, I remember nothing except for waking up at St. Vincent's Hospital here in New York. I was in the emergency room. It was really funny because when I opened my eyes, there was a nun holding my hand.
Oh, and you're like, am I dead?
Yeah, I was like, am I in heaven? Am I in Calcutta? You know, where am I? Because this is, I mean, I was the one holding hands in for the death and dying just a few months before. And she just was like, you are so beautiful. You know, God is with you. So then after that, I saw a neurologist, and they did brain scans and said that I have, quote, epilepsy.
Right.
Yeah. And started me on medication.
So this is, you know, it's such a, you know, one sort of plot after another in your life up until now. And so let's talk about how you begin to, you know, evolve into yoga and meditation and how that begins to transform you into the person that you are now.
So yeah, the modeling continued. I was very successful. I made a lot of money and was able to do great things for my family from the money. And they, you know, welcomed me back into the family because I was fairly alienated from them for a while. And then I was very much into, I've always been very much into exercise, in some ways too much. I think I used it as a way to not feel in the same way that I use drugs a little bit. I became a professional boxer. I would continue to run. I would do every...
To maybe not feel your feelings?
Yeah.
Well, stop for 1 second and tell me like who you were as a person at that stage. Like, were you feeling confident? Were you feeling lost in the world? Who are you at that moment?
The epilepsy was really hard.
Right.
It was really hard because you never knew when it was coming on. And it's not pretty, you know? There's a lot of shame and embarrassment around it.
Yeah.
And also to be venerated for the way that you look. And having dropped out of college, and my brothers and sisters are all brilliant. They all had, you know, masters and PhDs and, you know, just doing this amazing, amazing work in the world. And so I felt like I had nothing worth saying or giving except for my looks. And that's really hard.
So you weren't getting validated from the outside for anything but the modeling, and you didn't have yet a way to validate yourself internally.
Right. So I exercised and I exercised and I exercised and I went to this boot camp and that boot camp. And then I ended up with a guru, basically, martial arts. And that's all I wanted to. I lived for it in some ways.
Because you were trying to get away from your feelings. Were you?
You know, I'm
you
not
feeling?
Really sure. Yeah. I think it was the high as well. Like I
like the adrenaline. From
yeah, what? I realized at this point that I am a sensation freak. So then my girlfriend wanted me to take yoga. She'd been doing yoga for a long time. And I was whatever, you know. So I took a yoga class with her on Broadway in Soho. And I was frustrated because I thought that it would be a piece of cake for me because I was an animal in my body at this point. I could do anything.
Yoga's so easy.
Yeah, I was super. I was an anatomy lesson at that point. I was ripped beyond ripped.
Wow.
And, you know, to a fault probably looking back. But I looked around there and I couldn't do the stuff that they were doing. And I was incredibly humbled, first of all. Mm-hmm. And, but I walked out of that class and didn't understand the way that I felt.
Was it the class itself, or was it in Shavasana at the end of the class?
I have no idea. It wasn't until I got out onto the street in very familiar surroundings that felt, sounded, looked, tasted, sensed completely new.
Well, if you're an adrenaline junkie and everything's so fast and you're moving so quickly from one thing to the next, and this is your first experience, it must feel like slow motion too. Even though yoga's not always slow motion.
And this class wasn't slow motion.
It wasn't, but there was something that really tapped into you?
There was something that just felt sacred.
Mm.
I felt like when I was walking down the street, I feel my feet on the ground, I'm looking at these beautiful sights. Even the smell of the food carts, it was just like, I was awake.
Yeah.
And I don't remember feeling like that without drugs ever.
Yeah.
It wasn't an overnight thing.
Yeah.
I still continued boxing and running and doing all the other extreme sports until I was on a modeling job in San Diego. And I took a step aerobics class. And I jumped over the step and fell down because my back went out.
Mm.
Couldn't stand back up. I couldn't put any weight on my feet. Had to be carried back to the hotel.
Gosh.
Laid in the bed. I called 911, actually, because I couldn't move. And they came and they gave me steroids and pain pills and whatever else. And then they left and I was, you know, out. And when I woke up, I didn't really know what was going on. I got up to go to the bathroom and I fell and I scraped up a whole side of my face. And then I stayed on sleeping there for the night. And then when I wasn't in hair and makeup in the morning, they came and knocked on the door and found me there. Well, I still could barely put weight on. I put my arms around the hairdresser and the makeup artist and, you know, I sort of hobbled along. We were shooting bathrobes that day, and they did my hair and makeup, and they propped me up so you could only see the side of me that wasn't scraped and bruised.
Yeah.
So went back to the city, and make a long story a little bit shorter, I ended up having back surgery. That was in 94, and I've only done yoga since then.
And that's when you began. And so you do you do yoga and meditation every day in some form?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Like you don't have a day that goes
absolutely
by without it.
Even if I only have 5 minutes, I will do a meditation. And I mean, I do it all the time.
Yeah.
I do it on airplanes. I do it before I go to bed at night. I'm not necessarily sitting in formal meditation all of the time.
Right. Well, it helps you to really, really focus.
Once. No, if it's so much about focusing as it is about being in the body, being in the present moment, and uncovering love.
Yeah, I want to talk about that for a second, because I want to understand why is that in our culture we have that problem.
I think a couple things. We're always taught that we're not enough, that we have to work harder, get more, bigger, faster, harder, and then we'll be someone.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, you don't really ever feel like you're loved for you, right? That you're not good enough. And when somebody does love you for you, it's almost like, I don't deserve that. So it's like Teflon, you push it away.
So how do we feel more love for ourselves, because it feels like that's where it has to start, right? So even if somebody loves you so much and you feel slightly validated by that or wholly validated by that, you still need to feel that love for yourself. And that's what so many people are missing.
First, to realize that you feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Second is to do the work to figure out what are the obstacles that are keeping you from understanding that you are love. Mm-hmm. And whether those obstacles are some trauma, an incredible sense of emptiness, or like a hungry ghost that mm-hmm. keeps you having to drive and drive and drive. Sometimes it's jealousy and anger. Whatever these obstacles are, to just stop and sit with.
When you talk about women, not so much being broken, but you see everybody has something, mm-hmm. Some sadness, some shame, some vulnerability, and you want to bring them back to their original wholeness, if you will.
We're all wounded.
Yeah.
To be wounded actually means to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But then when we try to pretend like we're not that, then we are not being honest. And then we walk around with armor. And then everybody thinks that the armor is the way that you have to be. And then right. there's no real depth or communication. And then we just start to feel more and more isolated and alone. So what I'm really interested in is creating meditations, breath work, and asana that deals with the obstacles mm-hmm. to realizing that we are enough.
Yes.
And that there is incredible love no matter what you've been through, no matter what you've done.
Yeah. Do you look at a lot of these things that have happened in your life as a gift that has given you this sort of ability to feel this compassion for your students and your friends and your family?
I think that the experience that I've had so far could be considered a gift because it's brought me to where I am, and it's allowed me to be in touch with people and to maybe inspire them to find out their own path back home, mm-hmm. back to themselves.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I regret where I've been, because it's made me who I am.
It's your journey.
I still have insecurities. I still have days where I'm just like, I haven't done enough. I wish that I hadn't hurt so many people in the process. Mm-hmm. I wish I could go back and still have like those 3 years where I wasn't in touch with my family. Now that I'm a mother, I just can't imagine what I did to my parents. Mm. And I really wish I hadn't hurt them so badly. I mean, they are so proud of me. Mm-hmm. My mom passed away a few years ago, but I mean, I more than made amends.
So, Colleen, I want to ask you one more question, because I know you're on your way to an event and you're giving a presentation to probably mostly women, and you're talking about embracing the beauty in aging. Can you just give our listeners a little bit of insight into what you're going to talk about and maybe help us all a little bit with that?
One of the saddest things about our society is that only youth is venerated. Mm-hmm. And so when we get to a certain age, we feel like we're not valid. And society does make us feel that way, especially women. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to. And I think that we just need to own that we are valid, we are sexy, we are smart. And part of that is supporting other women. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I love what you're saying, that you have to really let go of that and own where you are and connect with other women that are in a similar place.
And feel beautiful, and feel valid, mm-hmm. and feel venerated, and venerate. And we just need to change the way that we see aging. It's not a disease. It's a privilege.
Well, and I love the confidence that comes with all of these things that you're saying, that you can stand up and say,
I'm 57, and you do stop wasting energy on things that don't matter.
Absolutely.
Because you don't have the energy to waste on it.
Right.
But unfortunately, we do waste a lot of energy on, I look in the mirror and, try to pull up my thigh skin and say, oh, that, I like that better, but so what? It is what it is.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
And it makes you in some ways more valid.
Yeah. If you're older and you're walking around angry for your life or for whatever reason, that's not beautiful. Right.
And I really think meditation can help.
Yes.
I really think meditation can help to find that sense of contentment. Mm-hmm. When you can go inside and realize that that's where the juice is.
Definitely, yes.
Instead of venerating youth, own where you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, everyone's scared of aging.
Right.
I mean, there's certain things, yeah. I mean, there's more aches and pains as you get older. Thank God for yoga.
Thank God for yoga.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. I'm happy to be 57, yeah. Honestly. I would not go back to 27 for anything in the world.
Well, look, you know, you've come so far, and you are beautiful inside and out.
Thank you, Patricia.
Yeah.
You are too.
Thanks so much to Colleen, and thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more inspiring stories next week. Be sure to check out Colleen at ColleenZedmanYee.com and check out her book, Yoga for Life, available at all major booksellers. Once again, if you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio App in the App Store. See you next week.